the computing systems and the computing infrastructure that we offer at Parameter. I want to give an overview, kind of a show and tell, of the kind of science that is currently done using computational and numerical methods. And in the end, if there's time, depending on you're interested, I want to show some alternatives to Mathematica in case you don't like it, or in case you have colleagues or friends who can't afford to pay a license for Mathematica, because that is quite expensive, and there are open source alternatives. And I'd also like to show some advanced features of Mathematica, for example, how to use GPU computing, or how to compile code that you use with Mathematica. That depends on how much time there is left over at the end of the lecture. But in the beginning, I want to give an overview over the computing infrastructure that we offer here at Parameter. You all have your laptops, and that is fine. But if you want to perform a big calculation, then it may be that you're just running out of CPU power or out of memory on your laptop. It doesn't matter whether you do a numerical calculation or whether you have a huge complex symbolic integral that you need to crack. It just sometimes you need more power. And we have some shared workstations for this. In other places, there would be individual research groups that buy large workstations just for that research group. At Parameter, we think that's a bit of a waste of resources if a student or a postdoc gets his or her own large computer. Therefore, we have a shared set of workstations that everybody can use, even you right now, if you wanted to. I'm just going to explain you how to do that and what we have available. So we have a multi-tiered strategy here. Kind of that means depending on how much computing power you use, you kind of move up in that level. In the beginning, there are the personal devices. You have your own laptops, or maybe you have your own, other people prefer to have their own desktops on their desk. And these, of course, are rather weak machines. They're mostly designed for simple calculations, email, internet, and so on. And then one level further up, we have what we call a scientific computing environment. These are high-powered, very large, powerful workstations. And at the moment, we have 7, 8, depending on how you count on them. And they're located in a server room. Actually, they are off-site in a server room in Toronto because it's cheaper to host them there, all the power requirements and the cooling. And you would have to use them remotely. You can use them either graphically or you can use the command line. And I can actually give a brief example for doing that if you're interested after this presentation. And you use them remotely so you don't get to sit in front of a keyboard. And these are Unix workstations, so you probably need to get familiar with Unix if you want to use them. Yes? Pardon? So these are 8-core machines with hyper-threading Intel processors. So if you look, you'd see 16 cores, but these are just 16 hyper-cores, 8 cores. And they have 48 gigabytes of memory. And at the next tier, we have a small HPC system with 30 nodes. They have about 100 gigabytes of memory and 12 Intel cores, and it's going to be extended. High-performance computing sounds cool, but it just means it's a bit more complicated to use. High-performance computing is usually used in a batch system. That is, you write a script, and you submit your script, and as soon as the compute nodes become available, it runs, and then you get your result. And the bad thing is that if you write a script, the first time you use it, you may have to wait hours or days before it runs. And if you know interactive, you try something, it doesn't work, you have a typo, you try it again, it takes you 2 seconds to fix a typo. If you have to wait two hours or two days to fix a typo, that's really inconvenient. So you have to be kind of an expert, and you want to try out something else before you use an HPC system. So you have already access to the SCE, but if you want to use the HPC system, we probably should talk, and you should get a brief tutorial if you want to do that. I assume some of you may be interested, and some of you may have used it already, another HPC system in another research group. That just depends on your previous experience. Yes? That depends on how busy it is. At the moment, I looked, all the nodes are busy and there are enough jobs queued to keep the system busy for another week, but we have multiple priorities. So if you want to run a very short job, it may actually interrupt a currently running job and it would run right away. But if you want to use the HPC system, then in the end, you probably want to have a calculation that runs a day or a few days or something, and then you'd have to wait as well. And on top of that, since these HPC systems are expensive to buy and maintain, we also give consulting for outside HPC system. There's a Compute Canada, that's a conglomeration of consortia, and one of these is SharkNet at the University of Waterloo across the park, and they have a large HPC system, I think thousands of nodes at the University of Waterloo. Then has a large one called SciNet at the University of Toronto, and of course in the States and Europe and so on, China, there are also computing, large HPC systems available. Okay, these are the different tiers that we offer. And if you ever need to get out of your laptop, if you need more computing power, then I'd be happy to help you use the scientific computing environment. Apologies. And I think I can also, after this talk, give you a brief presentation, show a brief interactive demo of how to log in, how to use that. If you ever need that, you probably have to get familiar with Unix and with the command line. If you don't know how to do that, you should probably try to pick that up at some point. There are tutorials available offered, for example, the University of Waterloo. Research technologies, that is my group. In a way, I am also a liaison between the IT department. The IT department, of course, that set up your computers. IT department runs the projectors, the laptop, all the AV here, and many other things. And I act as a liaison between the researchers, their needs, and the IT department, that is more of a technical department. And my group, or I, provide consulting. If you have questions regarding LaTeX or Mathematica, well, that's this course here. If you require a particular software package, want to have that installed on the HPC system or on the ACE, provide assistant consulting with other programming. If you have work in a group, in a research group, and have a large C++ Fortran project, whatever is available there, consulting on numerical algorithms or on other projects or publications as they need, maybe. And there's a, you know, the help ticket system at Perimeter, help@perimeterinstitute.ca. If you see anything wrong with a coffee maker, something doesn't work with the computer. And there's a similar address, consult@perimeterinstitute.ca, if you have questions or require consulting there. My office is Office 350. You're welcome to stop by anytime. This is the scientific computing environment that I just mentioned. We have seven. Yeah, it's growing, but I think it's still at seven. Seven regular workstations that I just mentioned. But one of them is called Compute. The other one is called Compute 1 to Compute 6. There are no restrictions on using it. You just log in to use it. Be nice to others. Don't overload the machine running out of memory. That can even happen accidentally if you have a large Mathematica calculation running. I know you mentioned they have 8 cores, 40 gigabytes of RAM. And at Perimeter, there are shared home directories. I mean, you have your own home directories on your laptop, but you have a Perimeter-wide home directory that's accessible from all the SE and HPC and other systems that we offer. It makes it easy to exchange files there. And there was actually a recent change. Now you have 2 home directories, one for all the Windows systems and one for all the Unix systems. Windows and Unix have different ways of handling file permissions, so it's always very tedious to switch over. That's why you have 2 home directories there. And there's one GPU machine. I don't know whether you heard of GPU computing. That's the new and upcoming thing in high-performance computing. The origin was that people use graphics cards that are built into laptops or other computers and use them for scientific computing. And these days, there are other accelerators specially designed for that. And if you can rewrite your program in a way that it runs efficiently on such accelerators, it runs 5, maybe 10 times faster than a regular CPU. So people like that. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to rewrite the programs. And many programs can't be designed in a way to run efficiently on an accelerator. But we have one machine where we have one GPU that is by now probably 3 years old. So it's not really top of the line anymore. To access the SE, you use SSH and the command line. You use your login name. That's your Perimeter login name. That's the same you use to log into the Perimeter network. And the password is the same that you use to go to the PI residence network. And compute.pi.local is just a computer. If you're familiar with Unix and SSH, you can just log in and look around. And you can use Mathematica. It's installed there. And I can show you later how to do that if you want to run such a larger calculation. Yes?
If we want to do this from our laptops, we have to be on the PI resident network?
Yes. So you, if you're here at Perimeter, you have to log into PI residence. PI public won't work. And if you're outside Perimeter, then you have to either use VPN, virtual private network. It is maybe installed on your laptop. If not, the help desk can help you with that. Or we can set up a session for all of you. That's maybe easier than 30 of you hitting the help desk. That get very angry. And alternatively, we have an SSH server from the outside, you can log in there, and from the SSH server, can log into these machines. And to make that work, you need to have SSH access enabled. That's again something the help desk can do. I think you should talk to one of your tutors about that, and that if you're interested in that, and then we can do it en bloc instead of one by one. I can give you, actually, let me do that just now, how to do that. But, I mean, what happened now? I press escape, nothing happens. See the pizza of death? Okay, very good. Do you see that here? Very good. So I opened a terminal on my laptop that's local here. If you're using Linux or Mac, then you can easily open a terminal. I'm not quite familiar with Windows. It has probably something called a... No, if you're using Windows, you probably want to install a program called PuTTY. Let me write that name down. You can download it and install it and run it, and it gives you something that looks similar to this terminal, and you can use SSH to log in to compute. So let me type, for example, SSH compute at pared local, actually, eShnetter, that's my IP address. Pardon? It should work on Linux and on Macs, but under Windows, you have to install PuTTY. I don't know what you are using. You probably have an Ubuntu virtual machine, don't you? So from that, that is Linux. From that, you can just type this in the command line there. But from Windows, you have to install this program, PuTTY. If you're interested in doing that, we can just interrupt for 5 minutes and wait while you download and install PuTTY.
Just check. I just went to the PuTTY website. And okay.
It probably is illegal in some weird countries. I don't know, North Korea and countries like that. It's definitely illegal in the regular Western countries. So the thing is, it provides SSH, and SSH provides encrypted communication between your laptop and other systems. And some countries place restrictions on what kind of encryptions you can use. But it is definitely legal in Canada. Okay, if you want to download PuTTY, do you want to briefly put your laptop here so that others can see how you download PuTTY? I mean, I can't show it because I don't have Windows. Yeah. Okay, and then we continue afterwards. Otherwise, we can do it this afternoon in the tutorial session, if you think that makes more sense. It doesn't matter, right? Time is time. Let's just do that. It takes 2 minutes. Quick. Come here. So I just put my laptop on the floor in the meantime, and you connect here. So this concerns you only if you're using Windows. If you're using Mac or Linux, you don't need to do any like that. You can just continue later with what I'm going to show you. PuTTY, yes, PuTTY.org seems to be the right web page. Download PuTTY, yes, that's probably the right page. Can you scroll down? There's something else. There is a zip file containing all the binaries. That's the best thing. Yeah, that download page, I don't know. It looks like straight like 1985. Okay. Sure, that's also good. Yes, double click that.
It's downloading
Yes. Well, that technology is tried and true. Okay, 4 seconds left. There we go. We double click the installer and you click on run. That was yes to confirm that you want to install it. And then PuTTY setup, you should be able to just choose the default options for all of that. PuTTY? It's open source software, yes. Yes, all the Perimeter residents have permission to use it. That includes all the faculty, postdocs, students, including you, all the visitors, and so on. Okay, yeah, that probably just means you're using the wrong username or the wrong password. But let's continue with that afterwards. So here, okay, so this is where you log in, where it says host name or IP address, you type compute. And then you click on open. You are logged into PI Residence, right? Very good. PI Residence is important. From PI Public, it would not work. It's not cached, that's okay. You get this warning the first time. It wants to prevent you to accidentally logging to the wrong system. The host name is compute, just compute. Sorry, I had that on my slide, I can't see it. Just compute, as in compute. Yes, hit yes. And then log in as, this is where you type your username, that's your perimeter username, not the login for your laptop. It's the one you use also for the PI Residence network. It's probably the first letter of your first name, and then all the letters of your last name. Probably, yes, no, that's probably it. And then your password, that's also your network password, they call it Windows password, perimeter password, anything. And then, yeah, it has this white on black color scheme that's not really readable. This is why we're switching to my laptop where I'm using black on white, but pretty, well, 85, right? Thank you. So this was a brief demonstration on how to log in on Windows. So let's continue with logging in on a Mac or on Linux, as long as the display is back. So here is what I type. Compute is the host name. Ishneta is my username. And then I have set things up so that my Mac stores my password. It won't ask me for a password, but it will ask you for a password if you log in. What is wrong now? That's all. PI resident, okay, that's good. Okay. Well, we have 7 of these systems. The other ones are called Compute 1, Compute 2, Compute 3, and so on. I'm just going to use a different one. This is a warning when you log into a new system for the first time. Just the same as we just saw on the screen. I'm typing yes. Ishneta's password. Oh, wait. It's compute.pi.local. Did you see? I typed compute at pi.local, and then it wanted to log into a computer name that is called compute at pi. Pesky. There you go. It works out of the box. And here, this is now my perimeter-wide home directory, my Unix home directory there. And you should see something similar. And if you're using Windows to log in, of course, this is now a Unix system. So you type ls to see all the files that you have there. Now, if you want to use Mathematica remotely, there are 2 ways to do that. One way is to use Mathematica on the command line without the graphical user interface, just with the kernel. Yes?
So I logged
in, but I don't have a directory yet. What does PWD say? No, but what is the output? So what is the output? Okay, yes, you have an empty directory. Type ls space minus a, and then it should see some dot files. Very good. Yeah, you don't have any files stored there, so that it's empty, okay. So if you want to use Mathematica the hardcore way, you type math, and then it looks like that. And then you can type 2 plus 3 and so on. And this is just the kernel directly. No graphical user interface, no going up and down, no scrolling, no fancy output and so on. But all the kernel facilities are there. So if you want to run a large complex program, this may be a good way of doing that. I'm pressing Control D to exit, but it's not really useful. If you want to use Mathematica graphically, you have to use what is called remote desktop software. And the one I'm using is XPRA. I don't want to show that here because it's a bit fiddly to set up, unfortunately, right, this being Linux and so on, but I have set it up for myself. I have created the display and given it the number 247. Oh, wait, sorry, I created that. on a different computer, log me into, let me log into the other computer. Pardon? Control D. Yes, there's probably also quit or something you can do. And then if I type Mathematica with uppercase M, then it starts the real Mathematica. This won't work for you, right? This display command won't work for you. I just want to briefly show that you can actually use Mathematica here. Now it starts Mathematica on the remote system, but actually the window will appear here locally on my screen. And yeah, for some reason that takes a few seconds. Hoping it works. Knock on wood. Give it just a few more seconds, please. Okay, almost there. They should have a progress bar or something. I mean, it doesn't help you anything, the progress bar, but at least something's happening. Anybody know a good joke that you can tell in the meantime? Sorry, you have a question? Yes, there's something called remote X forwarding, and that works. Unfortunately, it's very, very slow. Every time you press a key, you have to wait a second or something, because it's not designed for graphical user interfaces. And if you use remote desktop software that comes standard with Windows, but Linux, you have to do something special, then it's much, much faster. Well, the starting up apparently isn't really that much faster. I tried it 10 minutes ago, well, now half an hour ago before the lecture, and it's working. It just probably needs a few more seconds. Yes? Yes, so the graphics is the internal data structure that describes how to plot something. The graphical user interface can use that data structure to plot something. In the kernel, what you can do is write that data structure to a file, and that's basically all you can do with it. And then you can copy the file to your laptop, and then you can there open it in the graphical user interface and display it, and then you would get it. But obviously on the terminal, you can't do any graphics, it's just letters. Okay, this, I don't know. It just takes a bit longer. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. So, thank you. That's a good point. I was going to mention it later. In Mathematica, you can write files, and you can write them in two formats. There's a .nb format. It's a notebook. And that is the output format from the graphical user interface. And there's a .m format. It's the same suffix for MATLAB and for Mathematica. And that is just a program that you write, like C, Fortran, Mathematica, and so on. And that can be run directly by the kernel. And if you want to use the HPC system, or if you have anything that runs for a few hours or days, you want to use that .m format, not the graphical interface. The problem with the graphical interface is if you lose your connection to the remote machine, the process will die and you lose all the data that you have. You close your laptop, you go downstairs to get a coffee, you lose the calculation. And if you use the kernel and the .m files, then you can circumvent all of that much easier. Okay, this, I don't see much traction here, so I'm just going to wait a bit more while I continue with my presentation. We'll get back to that in a minute. Sorry. Really? Very good. And we had this one. Good. We were just on this slide. I was going to show you how to use Mathematica remotely. These are software packages that are available on the scientific computing environment. We discussed Mathematica, of course. Maple is the same as Mathematica, except most people here at the Institute use Mathematica, not Maple, but you're free to choose whatever you want. MATLAB is something that's more geared towards numerical calculations, not symbolic manipulations. Depending on what you do, either MATLAB or Mathematica may be a good choice. Magma is something that is only for symbolic calculations. It is even more symbolic than Mathematica. It's a corner case, but there are one or two people here that use it. And you see they all start with MA, probably for MA, for mathematics or something. Then there's SAGE. SAGE is an open source project that tries to recreate an open source Mathematica. It's pretty far advanced, but of course the syntax and everything is slightly different, and they're not quite there yet. But it's based on Python. If you like Python and open source, you can give SAGE a try. I mean, Googling for SAGE doesn't really help you because there are probably too many computer games and kitchen recipes containing SAGE. So Google for SAGE math, and then you'll find it. And it's an open source package that you can install on your laptop, or you use it on the SCE. It's already installed there. And if you've used IPython, IPython notebooks, that's the basis for SAGE. That's the thing. And yeah, there I mentioned IPython. If you're using Python, then you can use IPython. There's also a bit of symbolic manipulation there that also has a graphical user interface where you can do things, calculations. I was going to show you IPython as well, so let me do that. Although I shouldn't quit PowerPoint because it will crash again. If you type IPython notebook and have it installed, then your web browser will open, and it looks like this. This is my home directory. I can create a new notebook, and this is now a user interface that kind of mimics Mathematica. It runs in the browser with JavaScript, and the language that is available to me here is Python, not Mathematica. So I can calculate 2 plus 3 in Python. I have to press Shift Return again. That is 5. I can say x equals 5. Then x plus 1 is this. And if I type solve, what is it? X plus 1 equals 0 for x, then you get a syntax error because solve is not built into Python. You can type import stuff from, you don't need to remember that, right? This is just no Python syntax instead of Mathematica syntax, from SymPy, SymPy symbolic Python. I'm sorry. Do you know the right syntax for that? I thought it was import. Import SymPy. Sorry, there must be something wrong. Oh, now you have to declare that x, say x, y, and z, you want to use them as symbols. Otherwise, if something is undefined in Mathematica by default, it's a symbol that you can solve for. If something is undefined in other languages, Python, for example, using it is an error by default. So you have to actually define these symbols. Okay, I must have done something wrong here in my setup, sorry. But with a very simple command, you can get an environment where you can actually get SymPy to actually solve it as well. There must be something wrong with my setup here. Apologies. That's not a good introduction for an alternative to Mathematica, so I guess I now have you sold to Mathematica as if Wolfram had paid me for that. Okay, let me close that. And this, there's still not anything visible here that this... Okay. I'm trying a bit of magic to make the Mathematica work. If not, I'm going to give up. Give me 30 seconds. There you go. Look at it. Yeah. So I'm using this remote desktop software. I just needed to restart it. This is now Mathematica, and it's running. If you look at the title file, it says on NVIDIA. NVIDIA is the SCE machine that I'm using. So this is now running remotely. I can start a notebook. And as you see, the user interface looks slightly different. And if I type 2 plus 3, then you see that the output lags a bit behind, right? There's always a tenth of a second before the output comes there. But you can look at system information that gives you all the details of the hardware of the system. And then you see that it is actually NVIDIA. It says here the machine name is NVIDIA. We can look here at parallel, and then it tells you this machine has 24 cores. So it has a 12-core CPU with hyperthreading, is 24 cores. And there should also be something about the amount of memory that we can read somewhere. Did you see that somewhere? Front end? No, you don't see that. Anyway, by default, if you use Mathematica, it uses only one core, one processor. This machine has 12 cores with hyperthreading 24. You can use the others, and if things work right, of course, the calculation will run faster. If you have a very simple calculation, then you don't get any benefit from using the other cores. This is parallel computing, and it's very important to understand the idea behind parallelism. I want to give as an example a coffee shop. If you go to a coffee shop when there's one person behind the counter, and then you can compare that to a coffee shop where there are four people working behind the counter. So if you have 10 people waiting in line, and there are four people behind the counter, then of course things get faster, right? One person interacts with the customer asking what they want and giving them the sweet pieces that they want. The other person prepares the coffee. Third person takes the money or the credit card, and the fourth person hands out over the counter the coffees and whatever the people ordered, and it goes faster. But if you're a single person, there's no one else in line, and you interact with four people in the coffee shop, then of course it doesn't go faster, it's slower. You ask the first, so that the first person behind the counter would ask you, what do you want? You say, medium coffee with milk. And then all that that person does is repeat to the other person behind him, one medium coffee. And that doesn't speed things up. And then you walk to the cashier at the checkout, and that person asks you, what did you have? A medium coffee. And then you go to the counter where they get your stuff, and then they ask you, oh, what did you order? I had a medium coffee. And so in all this interaction, by dealing with four people, there's an overhead. It actually takes you longer. But if there are 10 people in the queue waiting, then it goes faster if you have four people working behind the counter. But for a coffee shop 405 is probably the limit. You probably have never seen a coffee shop where there are 20 people behind the counter. And the reason is, it doesn't help. There's not enough parallelism in there in talking to people, right? It doesn't work. And with computing, it's the same thing. If you have a really complex problem that can easily be split into different pieces, then parallel computing helps. But if you have something that can't be split into several subtasks, then using multiple cores or parallel computing won't actually speed things up. Now, since I'm locked here into the system, let me just show you how to use Mathematica in parallel. Just in principle, we won't actually observe any speed up. So there's this global variable $process ID, that is a unique ID for every Unix process that's currently running. Each kernel has its own process ID. If you type $process ID in Mathematica, and you can do that locally, you don't have to use it remotely or something. So if you have Mathematica open, you can just type $process ID, and it should all be getting different numbers in the whatever thousands or 10,000s range. And if we now create a table with four entries, then it is the same kernel that calculates all these entries. So we get the same process ID four times. And now if we do this in parallel, there's a command parallel table. This will execute the table in parallel. Each core will calculate a different element of the table. Of course, it will take much longer now because $process ID, evaluating that takes just a microsecond. What happens now? It launches four different kernels. Oh my god, it's going to launch 24 kernels because it realizes that the system has 24 cores. So on your system, you probably see four kernels or eight kernels, depending on your laptop. And then you will see that the process IDs, now we're there, are all different. So there's now one kernel, the master kernel, and these four compute kernels. And since they were started all right after each other, all these process ID look kind of similar. They all differ by whatever, 100 or something. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Good question. I don't know that, but there is some kind of parallel processing you can do without using multiple kernels. Using multiple kernels is like using multiple processes. There's also something like multi-threading. If you're using linear algebra, matrix algebra, that is multiplying matrices, eigenvalues, singular values, and so on, then the Mathematica built-in uses multiple threads automatically using the right number of threads. Even if you use only a single kernel, you don't have to deal with that. Now, if you run this command again, it should be much faster because the 24 worker kernels have already been started. There you go. Doesn't need to start anything anymore. It's just the same thing. And if we now want 25 of these, then we get the same thing. Actually, now there should be one number should appearing twice, right? Yes, here. So one of the worker kernels had to do twice the amount of work than the others. If you type parallel, you see parallel map, parallel table, parallel array. These are the things, the structures where things happen. I mean, where you want independent things happen. These can be parallelized. There's also a command parallelize. You can just try typing expression, put parallelize around it, and then hope that it runs faster. But it only works if you have many things to do, and if the things take all the same amount of time. If you have kind of 10 things to do, and one of these things is 10 times as expensive as the others, then you basically don't get any benefit from parallelization. Yes?
When you type process ID without parallel,
yes.
It gives you a number that's different than all the other ones?
Yes. So there is the kernel that's associated with the graphical user interface. And there are the worker kernels that where you can fan out where to. And this approach of parallel computing that Mathematica uses is called client-server computing or master-slave computing. I think master-slave doesn't sound politically correct. Client-server. So there's one client, and this client has many servers, and the servers do the work for the client. And the client itself doesn't do any work. So you're kind of 25 kernels running. One kernel, the client, just distributes the work, and that's all it does, like a manager. And then you have the 24 workers that do the actual work. Okay, I'm glad that actually worked out. That was parallel computing. Okay, let me try to go back to PowerPoint, see what happens here. Oh no, it did not crash. Look at that. Okay, so I was discussing the software that is available on the SCE and on the HPC system. Of course, the typical programming languages, Python, Perl, C++, Fortran, and so on and so forth, CUDA and OpenCL for GPU computing, if you're interested in that. We have the Intel compilers that sometimes produce faster code than the new compilers and the other compilers. And there are also some tools that are more for specific research groups, for example, RNPL, could be used in numerical relativity. SuperMongo is a visualization tool that's used in astrophysics. And Visit is a visualization tool if you have large data sets and want to visualize something. We already briefly discussed that. This is the HPC system that we have. The compute nodes there are more powerful than on the SE. The name is called Titan. Titan is one of the mighty gods, but that actually it's also one of the moons of Jupiter. And all the computing systems at Perimeter used to be named after planets and the solar system and so on. So there was Mars and Neptune as the SSH servers. The central file server was called Solar. It's now called Galaxy. And all the individual computers are named after moons. So Titan is one of the larger moons of Jupiter. It turns out that at about the same time when we called our HPC system Titan, there was also a really large supercomputer in the States called Titan inaugurated. It's just a coincidence. Of course, that Titan is a real supercomputer. It's probably 1,000 times as large as the one we have here in-house. It has 29 compute nodes, and these have 12 cores, and the cores run at 3.5 gigahertz. The ones in the SE run at 2.5 gigahertz. So that shows you that the compute node on Titan is about twice as fast. as one compute node of the SE. They have twice as much memory, and they use the same file system and so on. But you can't just log in and do something. You have to use a queuing system. So graphical user interfaces are out. You have to write a script, and you have to run a script. And that is always a bit of a hurdle to using it. It's very unfortunate that HPC, high-performance computing, is so difficult to use that you have to write script and that graphical user interfaces don't work. But that's just the state of the art. Hello? There you go. That was also already a question I talked about in the beginning, how you can access Perimeter from the outside. There are two choices. VPN is a virtual private network. That's a software that needs to be installed on your laptop. And the other one is to use an SSH server if you want to use SSH to log in from the outside. And I already briefly mentioned how to use SSH to log in to another system. Oh, I also wanted to show you how to copy files from your laptop to your Perimeter home directory on Mac. There are, let's get out here and out here. Yes, there are two ways for doing that. One is using SSH. SSH has kind of a sibling called SFTP. That's also part of PuTTY if you installed it. So you can write SFTP, /etc/compute. And then if you type ls in here, you see the remote files. If you write !ls, you see the local files. And then there are commands like get and put that you can use to move files about. And of course, that this is a rather low-level interface, right? ls and !ls, who remembers these things? There's also a graphical way of doing that. The graphical way is different between all the operating systems. I don't know how to do it in the Linux and Windows. We can figure it out. On Mac, you would use the Finder. You can connect to a server. And in this case, the server address looks like this. So you don't have to remember all of that, right? SMB, Samba, is the protocol that is used for something like HTTP, except it's for communicating files. Galaxy is the file server, I named that. And it's Ishnetter, Unix home, it's my unit home directory. And if I connect there, then my Mac opens a Finder window. And in this directory here, this here, the files that move, these are the files that I have stored remotely. And then, of course, I can just take drag and drop, look at different things. Takes a bit if you click something. I hope, but, oh, geez, that here. Yes, well, you can just now use drag and drop to move files. It's not very fast. If you use SFTP, the files are transferred much faster than via drag and drop because this SMB protocol is not very efficient. It's probably an OS, a Mac OS problem. And there should be one more slide. If you run a job on the SCE or on the HPC system, you probably want it to continue to run when you lose your network connection. With a graphical user interface, that's a bit complicated. XPRA, the one that I use, that I didn't explain to you how to use, offers that feature. The remote X forwarding that was mentioned earlier with the using the option minus X or minus Y to SSH, that definitely kills all your jobs when you lose the connection. And if you actually use a script to run something, then there are these options to run something in a persistent manner. If you're logged out, things continue running. One of these tools is called no hang up. If you lose the connection, the program doesn't hang up and it continues to running. You do it like that. You can use another program. That program is called GNU Screen. That's another thing you can't really Google. If you Google for screen, it doesn't help you. But GNU Screen would give you information. If you start the screen, that gives you a persistent terminal. If you lose your connection, you can log in again via SSH and can then restart, reconnect to the screen process and just project the job that you're currently running. I don't expect you to remember all the details here, but if you encounter the problem in the future, you will remember there is a solution for that, and then you can talk to me. I'll go back to the slides. Okay, this is the introduction to the Perimeter computing system that I wanted to present with a bit of an interactive presentation as well here. Do you have questions on that? I think some of you may be interested and will be using it and others are not interested, these others just keep it in the back of your mind. If you need it at some point, you can just ask. Okay. Then I would like to go on with the second part of today's lecture. Just give a very brief introduction to how simulation science, or how numerical science, how science, computational science work. This is an introductory talk I gave a few years ago, so some of the slides may not be appropriate to you. I want to show it to you anyway. So numerical simulations can be used to tackle a variety of problems. Here are some of the problems. For example, a crash test for two cars. Obviously, if you do the crash test in real, you have to build cars and then crash them. You probably have to build prototypes of cars. So a prototype of a car probably costs several hundred thousand dollars because it's built in manual labor, and then a crash test costs $1 million. If you can do it in a computer, that can obviously be much cheaper. You can do more crash tests and can improve the car, and that is good for everybody. Up there, that is the hockey stick. This is a simulation of a system of two black holes. They are visualized with shiny event horizons. Event horizons are not shiny. You probably know that. But in a visualization, we do that. And around that is a pattern of gravitational waves that is formed. You know, the two-body problem in electrodynamics, if you have a positive and a negative charge that circle around each other, emit electromagnetic radiation. I mean, assuming a classical non-quantum system, the same system also exists in astrophysics and general relativity. If you have two black holes orbiting each other, they emit gravitational radiation that could be detected by a detector such as LIGO that are currently being built. And we are simulating these systems to predict what kind of radiation, the waveforms, frequencies, and shapes that would be produced. This is a simulation of a fluid flow in a cavity. The fluid flow is driven here at the lid, and then you get a circular pattern that can be simulated. This is a collision of two neutron stars, similar to this one. And here, this is some kind of plane. And you get the pattern of the pressure around the wing. Again, in a simulation, it's often easier to find out what's going on than if you do the actual wind tunnel experiment. So why would you do numerical simulations? Sometimes you want to understand something. For example, if you build a combustion engine, and then the ignition happens, and that happens very quickly, right? The ignition happens in terms of microseconds. In setting up an experiment to understand how the flame propagation works and how you should shape the, let's say, the injection nozzle and so on, that is really difficult to get from experiments. But in a simulation, you can just zoom into everything if the simulation is reasonably close to the actual physics, of course. And then it's much easier to understand things that are otherwise much too fast or too tiny to understand in an experiment. You can also predict something. I used to work at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, near New Orleans, and hurricanes are a major problem at the coast, so you want to predict how the hurricanes move, and then you know whether to evacuate a city or not evacuate a city. And in the crash test, you want to engineer something better, or sometimes you want to do something cool, you want to do art. For example, in a video game, you create a virtual reality. And they have physics engines in there that are, I mean, it's not real physics that they do, but you can interact with an environment and that responds in a way that is kind of intuitively looks like physics. And so the basic idea on top, you have the laws that you want to simulate, laws of physics or something astrophysics, gravity, and something magic happens and out comes a simulation of the result. And actually, it's something magic, probably has two parts. First, you have to do numerical analysis, mathematics. You have to actually put the law of physics into a way that can be, that is amenable to numerical solving. So if you write down a PDE, a partial differential equation, that you can't really immediately solve it with a computer. You need to formulate it in the right way. It's actually a non-trivial step, and that is called numerical analysis. I completely glanced over that yesterday when we solved the Poisson equation. That happens to be a very nice equation. You can just put it in a computer and it just works. But the other equations need to be reformulated. You need to be very careful about doing that to get a stable formulation out. Otherwise, if you make that cut off somewhere, then you introduce just nonsense there in your approximation. And then, of course, you need to program it. You need to run it on supercomputers. That crash test, you couldn't run it on your laptop. because just the complexity of the model, all the individual shapes, pieces of the car, that wouldn't work there. That's another problem, but you need to choose, you need to program it efficiently so that you find enough parallelism in there so that it runs efficiently on a supercomputer. And a supercomputer, you may think it's just a really fast computer. That's really nice, but actually it isn't. A supercomputer is a large computer, not a fast computer. And is the difference between large and fast is the same difference as between a motorcycle and a truck. If you want to move from A to B, if you want to move house, then you don't get a fast motorcycle to move fast. You get a big truck, and the big truck moves fast, much slower than a car. But in the end, it's still more reasonable because the truck has a much larger capacity. And supercomputers are more like oil tankers, but I have the picture here. And that's why they are difficult to use. Because, I don't know, I think it takes 2 hours to stop an oil tanker if it's going at full steep, just going full stop. So you need to plan ahead, and supercomputers in a similar way. Everything is slow. Everything takes a lot of time. That's why they are so tedious to use. And you don't need to look at that slice, right? We describe physics in terms of partial differential equations. In many cases, you know that. An example for a PDE, I can also skip this slide, PDE interpretation, discretization. That is something that I mentioned yesterday. I mentioned it yesterday for, say, the piecewise polynomial ansatz. There are many different approaches that you can use. If you describe a continuum, for example, the shape of the body of the car or the movement of water or air, then you have infinitely many degrees of freedom in that fluid, in that field that you're simulating, and you break that up. For example, you can use finite elements. Then you would take the shape of the car, the body of the car, and break it up into small little triangles. Each of these triangles is actually rigid, but they are connected to each other. And thus you simulate that, and then if you use really small triangles, you get a very good approximation of how the car deforms in a crash and where things would break. There are finite volumes. If you simulate waters, that is a method used. You take a domain and you break it up into small cubes, and within each cube you assume that the density, pressure, and so on is constant, but then you have little density changes across the boundaries of the cubes, and then you can thus simulate something. And if you have smooth cubes that are small enough, you get a good approximation. The finite differences, that is very similar to what the second example I showed yesterday with the piecewise polynomial ansatz. The particle methods, if you simulate a cloud of gas, for example, you just break the cloud of gas up into small particles. These are not atoms or something, just chunks of gas, and you follow them around as they move and how they interact with other chunks of gas. And there are many more discretization methods that have been used. There's, of course, a discretization error if you do that, and that depends on the size of the discretization length scale that you're using. And if you have a finer length scale, you decrease the error, and it's important that you understand the order of accuracy. The order goes down sometimes as the length or the square of the length or the length to the fourth power. This would be a fourth order method that is already very good. If you make the discretization length scale smaller by a factor of 2, the error goes down by a factor of 16. That, of course, is a good thing. That means you can drive down the error quite a bit. And this is then how you simulate something, just as a black box. First, you choose a PDE that describes the system. You want to include all the important effects, but you want to exclude all the things that are just expensive to calculate and don't have any real influence on the result. Then you discretize the PDE. That is what we did yesterday. So you use a grid or cells, then you choose initial conditions and boundary conditions, and then you take many, many steps where you simulate the system. I don't know what the step size is for a hurricane, but the step size could be seconds or minutes. So if you want to predict how the hurricane looks like in a week, you have to break up the week into step sizes of a second and just move along. And billions of elements. These are commonly used in a supercomputer. Even on a small supercomputer like a Titan, you could use a billion elements. So really large simulations have many, many more elements. And this is the power of supercomputers, that you have a very simple recipe, and you just replicate that many, many times. And there's kind of a constant that if you are working on a PhD thesis, and you're doing one big simulation, one hero simulation, that takes about 3 months of time. Took 3 months 20 years ago to today, it still takes 3 months. That probably just means how much suffering you have to do, how much waiting for the final simulation, how much hoping that there's not a crash in the last minute. And then you have this watch simulation, and then you can analyze it. And it's like finishing one big calculation if you work analytically. And then afterwards, you see how far you get, and then you write your PhD thesis about that. If you simulate something, then of course it can be that your initial conditions or your boundary conditions are not good. Or it could be that the PDE that you chose is not appropriate for the system. You neglect an important physical effect, or the discretization has a problem. It maybe is too coarse, or maybe introduces an instability, and then the result may be just garbage. And that is very difficult. If the only prediction about a physical system comes from a simulation, then you need to be really careful about whether this calculation is good or whether it's just nonsense or garbage coming out. A brief introduction to the architectures of supercomputers. A supercomputer, I alluded to that earlier, is not just the laptop, just as really, really big and really, really fast. It is rather a system that is contains of a network of many, many processors, each of them maybe even weaker than what you have in the laptop. So most supercomputers are used remotely. I mentioned that earlier with Titan and the SCE that you have to use SSH and so on. And that's also the case for supercomputers. If you use it at the University of Waterloo or CINED or somewhere in the States, then you never get to meet the people who actually run the supercomputer. And supercomputers typically have one front-end head node where you log in, and then all the worker nodes. That is the very same model that you saw in Mathematica, where there's one front-end kernel running that doesn't do any work, and then you have all the compute nodes that do the actual work. It's the same thing, just in a supercomputer scaled up by a factor of 1,000. File systems interconnect, maybe not that interesting here. In my personal world, if a computer has less than 1,000 cores, then it's a really small system. We have a few hundred cores here, doesn't count. Between 1,000 and 10,000 cores, that's a medium-sized system. And if it has more than 100,000 cores, then it counts as a large system, and then it actually becomes difficult to use. Batch systems, I mentioned that before. You cannot just run something there. You have to write a script, and then you submit it to a batch system, and the script will wait for days or hours or weeks, and then it runs, and then you get the result. And it's very, very un-user-friendly. Using computers, supercomputers, I mean, it's expensive to build them. It costs about 3 cents to run on a single core on a supercomputer for 1 hour. And of course, if you're using, say, 10,000 cores in a simulation, then that's 30,000 cents per hour. And that amounts to real money if you run a simulation for a few weeks. So there's an allocation process. It's like writing a grant proposal where you get computing time. And then you have to use it nicely and probably use it in a sensible way. You can't waste it and have to write a report afterwards what you did with the computing time. Obviously not that parameter for Titan, because this is for software development and for training and so on. But for larger systems, you have to be careful, because it's easy to waste a lot of money by just burning computer time. Software, most supercomputers these days run some form of Unix, so you'd have to be getting familiar with Unix if you want to do computational physics. Parallel computing history. I don't know whether this is interesting here. Let me skip over some of the slides. So if you have, I mentioned the client-server programming model earlier, where there is one manager that distributes the work to all the workers. That works if you have 10 workers, but if you have 10,000 workers and one manager distributing the work to 10,000 people, that doesn't work. It doesn't work in a factory either, because then the manager becomes the bottleneck and can't talk to all the people. So instead, the workers need to be kind of self-reliant, talk to each other. And one idea that is prevalent, but is unfortunately very difficult to use, is message passing. That means that the workers can talk to each other by sending individual messages. So if you have a web browser and want to look at the web page, then you send a message to the web server. I want to look at this page. And the web server replies with the message, well, this is the page, go display it to the user. This is an instance of message passing. And here's an example of message passing in real life. For example, if you send a letter via the post office, you write email, that is message passing, right? Each letter is something like a message, that's where the idea comes. If you send text messages on the phone, that's also message passing. You send something, you get a reply back. Newspapers or Chinese whispers, are you familiar with Chinese whispers? Probably are, maybe you don't know the name, but you say a word to your neighbor and so on. Each person whispers on the word, and then it's fun to see what comes out in the end. Of course, usually what comes out is a very difficult word, because message passing, I mean, may introduce errors. You have to be careful about that. Or, and there are also conversations that are not about message passing. For example, the way we talk here, you can interrupt me. Several people can talk at the same time. That is not message passing. It is a much more convenient way to communicate, because message passing has all these weird constraints and the delays that it introduces. Watching TV is not message passing, because the TV just sends information to many people, right? Maybe a million people, the same message to a million people at the same time. Google Docs or other things allow you to interact with a document, to modify it interactively. That's also not message passing. World of Warcraft, because all the players interact with the game at the same time. That's also not message passing. That's more like stream processing. And if you have a large amount of data and when to store it on a supercomputer, then not every node can have the full information available because it's too much data. You split up the data onto the individual nodes, and that creates a major headache because each node then only owns a small part of it, and if the node needs to access something else, that becomes quite complex and tedious to program in message passing. So let's say we have a distributed array or a distributed list, and one worker, yes? So that depends. If you write, if you use MPI directly, and many programs are written with MPI directly, you have to do it all yourself. And starting about 5 or 10 years ago, there's a host of new computing languages developed that try to automate this. And it's still open whether it works. They work well in some cases, but not in all cases. So if you want to get into the field of high-performance computing, these are the kind of problems you have to deal with. Since you're here at Perimeter, you're interested in theoretical physics, so you're probably not that much interested in doing that yourself. But I predict that one of your collaborators or one of your students in the future will be doing something like that. So you should have an idea about, in general, how this works, even though you yourself may not be interested in suffering through that. It's my field of research, so I like tinkering with these ideas, finding better solutions. So for example, if you want to modify an element of a list that is stored in a distributed manner, you can't just do that because it's stored in a different process. So you have to first find out which other compute node owns that element of the list. Then you have to send a message to that other process saying which list element should be modified and what data should be put there. And then you need to check the other process needs to actually receive that message. And if it received such a message, it needs to modify that. And that becomes a complex 4-step procedure. And if you want to get an element that is stored somewhere else is even more complicated. You need to find out who has that element. You need to send a message to the other guy. Please give me that particular element that you have. The other guy needs to wait for that message, look up that element, send a message back with the data, and so on and so forth. And it's quite tedious and complicated. And it's not uncommon that you write a serial program, and once you write a parallel program, it's about twice as long. And the difference is in parallel details like that. I hope I didn't scare you away. I probably did. Amdahl's law is quite important to understand how much faster you can make something if you parallelize something. And that has to do not just with MPI programming, but also when you do something like parallel table in Mathematica that many of you may be interested in. The basic assumption here is that you have a large task and you want to parallelize it. Part of the task can be parallelized, and part of the task cannot be parallelized. Part of the task, say, has to be done by the manager. And then depending on the fraction that can be parallelized, there's a maximum speed up can you achieve. say there is 1/4 of the task that cannot be parallelized, that has to be done by the master, and say you have 10 workers, then we can look up in this table, 10 workers, that's about here, and if there is 1/4 of the task that cannot be parallelized, then we're on the red curve, 75% can be parallelized, and then you see at most it will run 3 times as fast, even if you have 10 workers. So you have 10 workers, you think it should be able to run 10 times as fast, but unfortunately you can only run about 3 times as fast simply because there's this 1/4 of the work that can't be parallelized. That is, I think it's kind of a trivial statement, it's just a very surprising statement. If there's 1/4 of the task that cannot be parallelized, then the maximum speedup is obviously a factor of 4, because 1/4 of the task, I mean, still needs to happen in a serial fashion. Yes? Well, the assumption is that there's 1/4 of the task that needs to be done by the manager that can't be parallelized. And then the question of parallelizing becomes kind of a search, a hunt for more parallelism. And that's really complicated. If you have a symbolic expression and you want to simplify it, how do you find parallelism in there? I mean, you don't want to crawl in the bowels of Mathematica and reprogram some of the algorithms there. Okay. Typical communication patterns. Okay. I want to close with showing a movie that was produced in a parallel, highly parallel calculation. This is the collapse of a star, a core collapse of a star, a supernova. There's a large star that at the end of its lifetime has burnt up all its fuel. So in the center of the star, the center of the star is now an iron core, several thousand kilometers large, and iron can't undergo fusion to go to any other thing. So the iron core does not produce any more heat, is not supported by that pressure anymore. So it will begin to collapse, and that initiates the supernova collapse of the star. And what we have done here is a simulation where we simulate the gravitational field, the hydrodynamics of the star, the gravitational waves that are propagated, and the neutrinos that are also generated in that. And let me play that again. Sorry, I want to play that again. What you see here is the specific entropy, which is something like the temperature. And as material falling in, what you see here in the center, this is just a small fraction of the star of the iron core. And you see material falling in and hitting a shock as it impinges onto that core that has collapsed. And then from the initial regular structure, you see convection and turbulence developing. And the curves that you see here, that is the neutrino signal. The neutrinos, there is initial large amount of neutrinos that is produced. The material that falls in is essentially has protons and neutrons, say 50-50. And in the center, you form a proton-neutron star where only a very small fraction of the protons survive. All the other protons are converted to neutrons, and that produces a large amount of entry neutrinos, of course, because of fermion number conservation. And this here is the gravitational wave signal that is produced. There are two polarizations of gravitational waves. They are both displayed here. And the hope is that there may be a supernova that happens close by in this galaxy, not too close by. And then the neutrino signal may be observable, and LIGO maybe pick up a gravitational wave signal. And by comparing them, one could confirm that our model of a supernova collapse, whether that is correct or incorrect. Because, of course, you can't look into a star. So you can't just observe what happens in a supernova simulation. Also, all the simulation in real life that happens, as you see in the time scale, in 100 milliseconds. So it's really difficult to get enough data to actually see what happens there. But with the simulation, one can make a prediction what happens. One can compare the results, the waveforms, to what is actually observed, if one has an observation, and thus confirm whether our understanding of a supernova is correct. And that is another simulation of a structure formation in the early universe, or in the universe, that of course is also something that can't be observed, because we can't go back in time to make that respective observation, and we can't create a new universe. Thought it was playing. So that movie was produced by a large collaboration, and you see the camera moving and zooming in while the simulation actually proceeds. These are large filaments that are formed in the universe. And what you see here are things like galaxies forming. And the cloud here, this is not a cloud of gas, but these are a cloud of many stars that sit there. Let me move the mouse cursor out of the way. And you see the time, and by the time reaches 13 or 14 million years, of course, the simulation will stop. And if you make such a simulation, you get some kind of structure for the universe. Of course, the initial conditions are somehow random, and you can confirm that, compare that to the real structure that you find in the universe. And of course, the simulation contains a particular model for dark matter. And if you compare that, then you can find out more about dark matter, whether the model is correct or incorrect. And of course, the color scheme that you see in here, so this is all fake, just for the sense of the simulation, because the only thing that comes out of the simulation is things like a density or pressures, temperatures, but these are not colors that actually would be observed in the universe. Okay, thank you. Questions? So of course, these were both movies were shown from large simulations that runs on hundreds, thousands, or ten thousands of cores, and runs for weeks, months, or even years. So this galaxy simulation, it was a really large simulation. I don't know how many months they were running on a really large supercomputer. So it's very tedious to write these simulation codes, and no one does that on their own. These are large international collaborations with tens or hundreds of people contributing. I mean, it's a smaller project like CERN, but it's always still a large project. But the outcome that you can do is not just a beautiful movie, but also a new scientific understanding of things that would be completely inaccessible otherwise. Okay. Thank you.